Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And my guest on tonight's show is the astronomer Phil Plait. Phil Plait, PhD, is a renowned astronomer with more than two decades of professional research and education experience. He has written articles for such magazines as Astronomy and Sky and Telescope, as well as national and international newspapers. He has appeared on television news and in documentaries many times, including the Sci-Fi Channel's Countdown to Doomsday and National Geographic's Is It Real? His website, Bad Astronomy, has won numerous awards, such as Best Science Blog of 2007. Phil has also written a book of the same name. On tonight's show, we'll be discussing Phil's latest book, which is Death from the Skies. Phil, thanks very much for agreeing to speak to Little Atoms today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So we're going to be talking about Death from the Skies, These Are the Ways the World Will End, your latest book. So perhaps we can begin, if you'll tell us, where the idea for the book came from.
Well, it's hard to say. I've always been interested in big, splashy, violent astronomical events, I suppose. I've always liked exploding stars and colliding galaxies, and there's been a sort of a resurgence lately in interest in that in the news and on the web and in TV shows. You'll see more things about asteroid impacts and such. And so I've always liked writing about astronomy, and I always look for some sort of hook to get people interested in it, whether it's explosions or something in the news or whatever, and I like to go a little bit more in depth than you usually get on your typical web page where it just says, ooh, look at the pretty picture. So it seemed that I could merge all of these things together, talk about these great violent events, and talk about the astronomy, the science behind them, make them a lot of fun, actually, you know, get people interested in this stuff, and maybe they'll wind up learning something by accident.
Well, this book has certainly got lots of explosions in it, so we may as well plow straight on with those. You mentioned asteroids just then, and indeed they are in the news at the minute. There are various groups. The UN has a working group looking at near-Earth objects at the moment. So we should probably start by talking about asteroids. What is the likelihood of an asteroid collision wiping us all out, I suppose we should begin with?
Well, it's kind of funny. The statistics of this sort of thing are a little bit funny. You know, the Earth is impacted by 20 to 40 tons of meteoric material every day. And so we're constantly being barraged by this stuff. It's harmless. It just burns up in the atmosphere. But the bigger the particle, the rarer they are. And so to see something like a really brilliant fireball that might be caused by something the size of, say, your head burning up in the Earth's atmosphere, that happens every day. But to have something that's maybe a couple of meters across that might get as bright as the moon, that doesn't happen very often at all. One recently fell over Darfur in Sudan. There was another one just a few weeks ago in Canada. And right here in Colorado, not far from where I live, something very bright burned up just the other day, and unfortunately I missed it. And so the more dangerous these things get, the rarer they are. And if you work out how often they hit versus how much damage they do, you can calculate the odds and find that your odds, you specifically, of dying in an asteroid impact are about 1 in 700,000, which is incredibly low. And you know, mostly this is dominated by the really big ones. Something really big hits, it can wipe out all life on Earth. It kills everybody. But they're extremely rare, and when you average this out over your lifetime, you know, the odds of getting killed by an asteroid are roughly the same odds of getting killed in an amusement park by having some accident on a fast ride. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't take it seriously, because one day one of these things will be coming in, and so we have to do what we can to prevent them from happening.
And of course, it's happened before.
Oh, yeah. You know, you could ask the dinosaurs that, but you can't, because they're dead. And they're dead because something the size of Mount Everest slammed into Mexico 65 million years ago. And, you know, look, 100 years ago in Tunguska, Siberia, this place out in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness of Siberia, a chunk of rock probably 30 to 50 meters across blew up in the Earth's atmosphere a few miles above the surface of the Earth. The shock wave flattened trees for hundreds of square kilometers, set fire to them. And if this happens over, you know, anywhere on the Earth today, let alone a major city, it could kill a lot of people, do a huge amount of damage. And so it's really important that we take this stuff seriously.
Well, of course, if we were suddenly threatened, you know, if astronomers did discover a near-Earth object that was heading for us, obviously people will be familiar that one way of tackling this is to you know, send a team of actors up on a space shuttle to land on the asteroid and plant a bomb. And it seems that the likelihood of success of this actually happening in depends on whether or not you've rented Armageddon or Deep Impact as to whether or not it actually works or not. But as I said, you know, the governments are looking at this, and there's a UN working group. So let's talk about some of the ways in which we could, once we've discovered that this rock is coming, how could we deal with it?
Right, we can finally find a use for Bruce Willis. That's really nice. In fact, sending people to an asteroid at all is the worst solution, because you need a huge rocket, and we don't have the technology to build anything that size right now. You'd have to get there, you'd have to land them, you'd need a bomb that would be so huge that we don't even have the technology to build it. I mean, the bomb that was in Armageddon was ridiculously huge. There's nothing even remotely close to that possible with our modern technology. And it turns out that blowing up an asteroid is probably not the best thing to do anyway, for a lot of reasons. One is that, you know, they're big, and blowing them up can be hard. It depends on their consistency. If it's made of solid iron, it's really hard to blow one up. There's another kind that's basically like a rubble pile. It's almost as if they're just huge piles of gravel held together by their own gravity. It's very odd. This is a new idea. It's only been around a few years. But we're pretty sure that a lot of asteroids have this sort of consistency. After a lot of slow impacts with other asteroids, they basically shattered in place. And so it's like a giant bag of gravel floating out there. And if you lob a bomb at that, it can absorb the impact of the bomb and still hold together. So blowing them up is probably not the best idea. Another idea, which was actually kind of cool and may still work, is to blow up a nuclear weapon near the asteroid. And what that would do is heat up the surface material, which would vaporize, turn into a gas, and expand. And that would act like a rocket, pushing the asteroid in the other direction. And this will work, but you can't control it very well. And so what they've come up with as what may be the perfect solution is to launch a rocket that has maybe 20 tons of mass. It weighs about 20 tons. And it will go near but not actually land on the asteroid. And you use the gravity of the probe itself to pull the asteroid into a safe orbit. And it takes a long time, and it depends on the mass of the asteroid and how long we have and all of that. But it looks like this sort of technology is the easiest to do and will, in fact, work.
So, I mean, again, obviously in the films, because it's Hollywood, the timescale of this is incredibly short. There's probably a month to deal with it or something. But I mean, what you're just describing, I mean, you're really talking, discovering these things years in advance, aren't you?
That's correct. Now, in Armageddon, for example, they discovered an asteroid 1,000 miles wide 18 days before it impacted the Earth, which is insanity. In fact, we know where everything is that's bigger than a couple of miles across. So, not that small, but some on that range, 10, 20 miles across, something like that. Anything bigger than that, we've seen for centuries. And so it's kind of ridiculous to think we'd only have a couple of weeks' time. What we're hoping to do is maximize the amount of time between the discovery of any object and when it might potentially impact. And the biggest concern are these rocks that are in the 100-meter to 1,000-meter range, because these are the ones that are kind of toughest to see but can still damage us. They may not hit the ground. They may blow up in the Earth's atmosphere. But if that happens over a city or over a populated area, it could really do a lot of damage. So we really do want to look very carefully, very closely at the sky, map all these things out, get as much time in advance as possible so that we can figure out what to do about it should we see one headed our way.
Okay, well, let's move on. You go on to talk about various effects of the sun, solar flares, and sort of magnetism, and then the possibility of us being affected by a supernova explosion somewhere else in the galaxy. But what I'd like to look at more closely is the idea of gamma ray bursts, which is interesting because it's a phenomenon that was observed and sort of, and has been sort of investigated very recently, isn't it? So. What are they and where do they come from?
Of all the objects, of all the events I talk about in the book, I think gamma ray bursts are the ones that really creep me out the most.
Mm-hmm.
This is a relatively new phenomenon. They were only discovered in the 1960s during the Cold War, when we were looking to see if the Soviet Union was blowing up, testing nuclear weapons out in space. And so we designed these satellites, which went up, to detect gamma rays, which are very energetic particles of light. And we didn't discover any nuclear weapons going off. That gives off gamma rays. But none of those was ever found. Instead, what they found were these flashes of gamma rays coming from deep space. And for 30 years, these things were a complete mystery. Nobody had any clue what could be doing it. But then in recent years, we've learned that what these things are, there are two different kinds of them. They're called gamma ray bursts of gamma rays. There are two different kinds, but the kind most people think about are when a massive star, very massive, 100 times the mass of the sun, ends its life and detonates. It explodes as what's called a supernova. And a black hole forms in the core. And all kinds of weird stuff happens. There's all sorts of forces at work. But in the end, what happens is you get these two beams of energy. It's a little bit like a lighthouse. And these two beams come screaming out from near the black hole at the speed of light. And the amount of energy packed into these beams is just unbelievable. It's like the sun's entire lifetime output of energy over its 10 billion year lifetime emitted over a few seconds. And so if you're within 1,000 light years of one of these beams, you're just going to wipe out life on your planet. You're just dead. And if you're 100 light years from one of these beams, which is incredibly close, it would actually, the devastation is unbelievable. I mean, it would set fire to the planet. Now, the good news is none of these things is very close. The ones that we see, and we see these every day going off somewhere in the universe, but they're tremendously far away, billions with a B, billions of light years away, halfway to the edge of the universe. And so they don't pose a danger at all. They're incredibly faint. Now, if one were to go off in the Milky Way galaxy, it would be dangerous, or at least it could be. And there are a couple of stars that kind of, sort of, maybe could go off as gamma ray bursts. But the good news with them is that one of them is pointed the wrong way. So it's like aiming a gun in the wrong direction. If it turns into a gamma ray burst, it'll miss us. And the other one is maybe a little bit pointed our way. When I first read about it, I thought, that's not good. But it turns out if they're more than about 7,000 or 8,000 light years away, they can't really do that much damage to us. They can hurt us a little bit. And this one is right about at that limit. So even if it were going to go off as a gamma ray burst, even if it were aimed at us, if you lined everything up just right, what would happen is it would hurt our ozone layer a little bit, probably less than we're doing now with CFCs. So I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Well, one of the things, this may seem like quite a stupid question, really, but you're talking about a phenomenon that happens, I mean, literally in a couple of seconds. That's all it takes for these bursts to go off. And yet we're also talking about something that's billions of light years away, as you said. Although it's like, it's moving incredibly fast, are we still talking about the fact that this 2-second event happened billions of years ago in reality?
Well, you can argue back and forth about what the nature of time is, and you know, did this happen billions of years ago, or can you consider it happening now? The important thing is distance. That's mm-hmm. the really critical part. The farther away these things are, the less danger they are. It's just like sticking your head in an oven. You know, it's very hot, but if you're standing 20 feet away, you can barely feel the heat at all. So these ones that are billions of light years away, the pulse of energy just lasts for a few seconds or maybe as much as a couple of minutes. But it's incredibly faint. You need a telescope to see these at all, usually. But the closer they are, the more dangerous they become. And even though the burst still only lasts for a few seconds, the amount of energy it would dump onto the Earth would be huge. So, you know, basically a nuclear weapon blows up and it only takes a couple of seconds to release all mm-hmm. of its energy. But it's still really dangerous. You don't want to fool around with that kind of stuff. And again, so even though it's only a few seconds, it can do a lot of damage. The good news is that even though these things are a lot of fun to think about, they really can't do us any harm because they're, as far as we know, they're all too far away to really hurt us.
Okay. Well, I mean, you mentioned how it's created there in the basically on the edge of a black hole. A black hole is something that most people will be familiar with. The image of the idea of a black hole, but people probably aren't that familiar with what a black hole is. So let's just talk about that now. What is a black hole?
Black holes pop up a lot in my book, as you might mm-hmm. expect. They're dangerous when they're born. They're born in the cores of exploding stars, and that's not a place you really want to be. They're dangerous on their own. They're dangerous when they die. Black holes can actually evaporate over huge lengths of time and explode. When black holes eat food, when they eat matter swirling into them, they can actually emit tremendous amounts of gamma and X-rays, and if you're too close to that, it can fry you. And so they pop up a lot when you're talking about the destruction of the Earth. Now, of course, we've all heard about a black hole. What is it? And really, all a black hole is an object that's incredibly dense, incredibly small, so that its gravity is very strong. And if you were to replace, for example, the sun with a black hole of the same mass, we wouldn't even really notice it because we're really far away. The gravity at the distance of the Earth from the Sun that we feel would be just the same. The thing about black holes is, as you get closer to them, the gravity gets very strong. And so if you had one floating out there in space a long way off, it's not a big deal. We see black holes all over the universe. It's when they get close that things get bad. Now, the odds, again, I like to talk about the odds of all these things because really these are all statistically unlikely events. Though in the entire lifetime of the universe, there's probably never been a black hole that's gotten close enough to the Sun to do any sort of damage to our solar system. But the whole point of the book is to have a little fun with these ideas. If a black hole were to pass through the solar system, it would toss planets aside like they were nothing. It could actually destroy the Earth. It would rip the Earth to shreds and then whip around the Sun and then head out into deep space. And so the details of this scenario are kind of actually interesting to think about. How would we detect it? What could we do about it? You know, nothing. And what would actually happen?
Let's just go into a little bit more detail there about what actually happens then. If we were out flying in a spacecraft or you know, just an astronaut out in space and were somehow brought into the gravitational pull of a black hole and were sort of inexorably being drawn towards it, let's talk a little bit about what would actually happen to us.
Sure. It depends on the black hole. If a black hole has a few times the mass of the Sun, and we know that these exist, we've seen them out there, it's an interesting effect. You can get to within a few miles of these things. They're very small. They're only a few miles across. And their gravity is so intense that the gravity you would feel, imagine falling feet first into a black hole. The gravity on your feet would be substantially stronger than the gravity on your head, even if they're only separated by a few feet. And so what would happen is the black hole would basically tear you apart. It would be pulling on your feet like a million times more strongly than it would be pulling on your head. And so it would be like having somebody, you know, a team of 200 people playing tug of war, you know, half the people on your head and half on your feet. It would shred you. And so we actually call that spaghettification, because it's like extruding pasta out of a pasta-making machine or out of a toothpaste out of a toothpaste tube. And so that's how it would kill you as you fell into the black hole. And then, of course, once you fall in, you're done. There's you can't get out, and so that's it. Now, if the black hole is much larger, and we know these exist as well, there are some that have the mass of a million times the Sun, or even a billion, and these exist in the centers of galaxies. The Milky Way galaxy has one in the center. That wouldn't happen. The black hole is so big that basically your feet and your head are roughly the same distance from the black hole, and so you would just fall in. You wouldn't feel that stretching at all. But you're still dead. You know, you're falling into the black hole, and down you go, and that's that. You know, you've gone over Niagara Falls, and you're gone forever.
You bring up the idea of what you term primordial or quantum black holes, like very, very, very small black holes. What are they, and where do they occur?
This is a theoretical kind of black hole. We've never actually seen any evidence of them, but theoretically they could exist. They would have been born maybe in the Big Bang itself, when there were lots of forces and pressures being tossed around, and it could have squeezed a little bit of matter, maybe, you know, the size of the Earth, for example, into a black hole. If the Earth were to be crushed down into a black hole, it would only be about a centimeter across, the size of a marble, smaller than a golf ball. And maybe even smaller masses, something with the mass of a mountain. That would create a black hole smaller, actually, than the nucleus of an atom. And these could be out in space, and of course we'd never see them. They're too small to see their effects. But if one were to fall into the Earth's atmosphere, and it had enough mass, it could actually draw in some of our atmosphere, probably not very much. It depends on the mass and everything like that. But what's interesting is that the friction of the matter falling in could actually make these things extremely bright. They could outshine the Sun as they fall in, and they get very hot. They would set fire to everything underneath them, and then it would fall through the Earth and then pop out the other side and keep going through space. If somehow it got trapped inside the Earth, it could actually eat the Earth from the inside out. And then, you know, after some amount of time, 1,000 years or a million years or whatever, the Earth would be swallowed up by this thing. But, you know, we don't even know if these things exist. If they were to sweep into the Earth, they would just go out the other side. It's extremely difficult for one to get trapped inside the Earth. And you know, even if all this stuff happened, it would probably still take millions of years for the Earth to go away. So, you know, I'm not lying awake at night, you know, sweating, staring at the ceiling, worrying about quantum black holes. It's more of an interesting thought process than anything else.
Well, while we're talking about the idea of objects passing through the Earth, let's talk about, you talk about neutrinos quite a lot in the book as well. So let's talk about neutrinos. What is a neutrino?
A neutrino literally means little ghostly one, or little neutral one. It's a subatomic particle that was only discovered in the 20th century, and it has this kind of bizarre property that, unlike, you know, a baseball or a particle of light or something like that, it can actually pass through ordinary matter very easily. And so you could have, you know, you've heard these numbers, you could have a light year long tube of lead, and it still wouldn't absorb a neutrino. And these things are created all the time. They're created in nuclear processes. So, for example, in the core of the sun, where hydrogen is being fused into helium, neutrinos are being emitted. And these pass through the Earth all the time. And they're usually not a problem. And in fact, it's difficult to come up with a scenario where they are dangerous. In a supernova explosion where you have a tremendous amount of fusion, if you were roughly 100 million miles from the center of the supernova explosion, you would absorb enough neutrinos to actually kill you through radiation poisoning. However, if you're 100 million miles from the center of a supernova, you have bigger problems. You know, you've got a vast explosion happening right in front of you. You're going to be vaporized at the same time. So it's kind of funny. That close to a supernova, it's kind of a question as to what's going to kill you first. There's 10 different things that are going to wipe you out.
Okay, so let's move on to one of the other areas that you look at in the book, which is the idea of alien invasion, I'd say, for want of a better word. And we've actually sort of talked about on the show before, we've had Seth Shostak of SETI on, and we've talked about some of the ideas you talk about, like the Drake equation, for instance, in terms of the ideas of intelligent life finding its way to us. But I'd like to talk about the idea of transpermia, which is something we've not discussed before on the show that you talk about. What's that?
The idea of panspermia is that life did not form on the Earth. It formed in space and then fell to Earth. And so if you look at something like, say, Mars, for example, mm-hmm. Mars is smaller than the Earth. It's farther away from the sun. And so it cooled more quickly after the formation of the solar system. So while the Earth was still hot and still trying to figure out how to get an atmosphere and water on the surface, Mars may have already been habitable long before the Earth was. So you can imagine a scenario where bacterial life, or maybe unicellular life, just something, single-celled animals or plants or whatever, were thriving on Mars. And then an asteroid could impact Mars, and it is quite possible, as surprising as this is, it's quite possible for the intact rocks with life in them to get shot out into space and then eventually impact the Earth. And so life on Mars could have seeded Earth. Now, this is totally theoretical. We don't know if this is possible. We don't know if it happened. We still don't know if Mars was ever habitable. But the idea itself has some merit. And we've detected amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. We've detected these in space. We've detected them in comets. And so it's possible that comets could have some sort of bizarre proto-life on them, and then they hit the Earth and seeded the Earth with life that way. On the other hand, it's entirely possible that life just originated here. The impact of this on my book is that you can imagine something like a virus or a mm-hmm. bacterium originating on some comet or something like that, coming to Earth and wiping us all out. It's the Andromeda strain scenario, named after the Michael Crichton book and movie. But what I found as I looked into this is that it's incredibly unlikely. A virus is a very simple sort of life form. It's so simple that people argue if it's even alive. But they're targeted. They're specific to DNA and RNA. And so something that evolved out in space probably would not be able to attack our DNA. It would just be completely incompatible. And a bacterium, which only needs a warm, wet spot to live, a bacterium from space could potentially fall to Earth and wipe out everybody on the planet. But the thing is, bacteria are much more complicated, much more fragile, and so they probably cannot form out in space. And if they could, they probably wouldn't survive coming down to Earth. And so, it's hard to quantify this, But the way I look at it, I don't think either of these scenarios is very likely at all. If it were likely, it would have happened over the 4.5 billion year lifespan of the Earth, and we haven't seen it happen yet.
This is true. Okay, well, we're quickly running out of time, but let's finish up with quite a big finish. I mean, you towards the end of the book, you discuss basically how ways in which the universe itself could end. So let's perhaps spend a minute exploring that. How do we see the end of the universe?
Well, that's an interesting thing because you have to start thinking about really, really huge numbers. Mm-hmm. Like a billion isn't big enough. You know, the universe is almost 14 billion years old, and you have to extrapolate into a future where 14 billion years is like the tick of a clock. We're talking trillions upon trillions of trillions of years from now. And all the stars will have burned out. Even the very lowest mass stars, which have a lifespan of a trillion years, are gone. Matter itself starts to decay. There's an idea that protons are not stable and that eventually they decay, but it takes, you know, 10 to the 35 years, a one with 35 zeros following it. So huge amounts of time in the future. But in that amount of time, and, you know, that will happen, it's possible that matter itself will fall apart and that the universe will just be a cold, thin soup of subatomic particles. There'll be no stars, no planets, no people, just this weird soup of stuff floating out there. And it was actually fairly depressing writing about this. But there is a possibility of the universe regenerating itself. There are different ways this might happen. We don't understand this stuff terribly well. These are all new theories. But it is possible that there could be another Big Bang or something like it, which could rejuvenate the universe, pump more energy into it, and then start the whole process over again.
Okay, well, that's great. Phil, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure discussing our inevitable extinction with you. The book, again, is called Death from the Skies. These are the ways the world will end, and it's published by Viking. So, Phil, thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.